I'm Kevin Power, and this is Sascapes, the podcast featuring stories of arts, culture, and heritage in Saskatchewan.
One, and a two, and a one, two, three, four.
It's Jeffrey Straker, live and in person, finally, my God.
It's great to be live and in person with you.
I feel like it's taken about 100 years to make this happen.
At least 100, yeah. I lost count after 99, so I just, yeah.
I know, but at least we know we can email.
Yeah, we're good at it.
And we reply quickly.
Yeah.
Actually, I think I found out about, what's... Early on when I returned here that your laptop was stolen.
That's right. So
that's when I first contacted you.
Yeah, yeah.
I was having morning coffee and I heard it on CBC.
There you go.
And I thought, if that happened to me, I think I'd hurl myself out the window.
Yeah.
And you sounded devastated. Yeah, because you had all of the music for your next album on that, right?
Yeah. There were like 60 plus songs that I'd written over like the whole previous year. And it wasn't like one... blocked off chunk of writing time. Like it was like writing here and there and off and on, and you know, and then they accumulate over that time. And then, you know, I had this batch of 60 or so tunes, and I was just like finally feeling like I was like, you know, every now and then in your cycle of doing your thing and all the various things you do in the arts, I felt kind of caught up. I was like, this is great. I'm kind of caught up and ready to go make this record. And then literally the next day, everything was stolen. Like
it was. And did you have copies of anything?
Well, I did. I had two backup drives, which were also stolen.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So, like, all my electronics were really stolen. So, like, I went for dinner for an hour. Like, and in an hour, the house was rifled through. It was pretty crazy. It's almost like I'm all rebuilt now. Like, everything's back. It's all fine. But it's almost funny to think about now, like, how unlikely it is. Like, you know, that like, because they had time to sort of rifle through stuff and find my backup drives and like take those too.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you know, or this person or there, whoever it was,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I don't know, like whatever. So, yeah.
But how'd you get all the music? How did you just have to try to write it again from memory?
Yeah. And most of it like wasn't committed to memory because there were new songs. So, like, my writing process is that I love space between when I create it and like a bit of space to go back to it to then try to have a bit of a filter to have the objective ears of, is this good or not, right? Because if you're really, really close to it, at least from my experience, if you write a song in that moment, it's the best song you've ever written.
Right.
Like, you know, and then so I like to leave space so I don't commit things to memory right away. And then, so therefore, a lot of things weren't in my head solidly. A few were, but I really ended up writing, starting all over again.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, it's good that you could do that you weren't just so ticked off that you couldn't even recall what it was. Because I'm assuming that all those songs were written influenced by something. So you had to kind of go back and dig up those memories.
Or just start with new ones.
Right.
Like one of the songs on the record ended up being this one called Luck Ain't Chasing Me, which wouldn't have been written had I not been broken into.
Right.
So, you know, some of the motivation changed, actually. But
so you've been able to reframe it as that song would never have been born had that not happened?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And quite a few of them, really. You know, like, you know, so you know, onward and upward, really. Like, I felt sorry for myself for like about a week and moped around. And and then I was just like, oh, well, that's not going to fix this. So,
right.
So off we go. Yeah. So, but
let's go back just a couple of days, weeks, years before that to when all of a sudden the world learned of a little tiny baby named Jeffrey Straker. In what small town in Saskatchewan?
Where I was born?
Yeah.
Punishai.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah.
Because that's where your first teacher was.
Yeah, Vicky Young.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But, so you were born and grew up there.
Mm-hmm. I was born on a farm just outside Punishai and like 4 miles from town, and did all my schooling there. And the school, I mean, this might be too much information, but the school didn't have an arts program, being a small town, rural elementary and high school. So there was no music education per se in the school system. But luckily, we had Mrs. Young, who was this local music teacher. And she wasn't only a piano teacher. Like, she was a really good piano player and a wonderful singer. Like, she had a great voice. And she was a trained soprano. And she kind of taught everything. Like, if someone wanted to learn something, she could figure out how to play it and teach it. And she did. Like, she was there when I wanted to start playing the piano, you know. And I was seven, I think. And so she was great. We'd go for these half-hour lessons, and I really wanted to practice. Like, I really enjoyed sort of the instrument and the rigor of learning it from an early age.
Yeah.
Crazy thing was, like, even though the school system didn't have an arts program in it, the principal then, Mr. Bonner, who some people may know, I don't know, but he had enough foresight and, I guess, enough of a heart for the arts, even though he couldn't afford it per se in the school, that his rule was whenever Mrs. Young had you scheduled, you could just walk out of your class and walk across the street to your lesson. Like, it didn't matter. So it was pretty cool. Like, you know, when you think back in hindsight, not a lot of places would allow that.
Right.
So that was great.
But your mom also played. She was a church organist.
She was a church organist for years and years and years. And she played piano. Actually, like, really, she played piano. But she played the organ because, you know, that's what was in the church. And she was really good. She is really good. She has about a grade 8 conservatory level of like, playing by note. But she has an incredible ear. So her ear is amazing. And so my lessons were all, like, the conservatory method, and the conservatory method for all of the things I love about it, its ear training is horrific. But my mom had a great ear, so I learned all my ear training through her. Right. So luckily I had a lot of ear training too. So that's helped me obviously in doing the stuff that I do now.
And your father was an auctioneer.
My father was an auctioneer and a farmer. So he was first a farmer, a grain farmer, and then, as most farmers had to do when farming was on that scale, they had to diversify and do something else to support the farm. Like, the model was a bit screwed up because they were doing something else to support the thing that was making no money.
Right.
But whatever. But everyone did it, and it was a lifestyle, right? So his thing was auctioneering, and he was quite good at it. He's retired from it now, but he was good at it, and the auctions were great. And there was almost, like, I think it would be safe to say there were people who came to watch the auction and not buy anything. Because, like, it was fun. There was fun. It was a bit of a performance, right, in a way, right? And auctions are, like, they have to be in a way. I mean, you obviously want people to bid and buy stuff, but it has to be interesting. So it's an interesting sort of context, right? Like, growing up on a grain farm and with a dad who's an auctioneer, and my mom did various things. I mean, she was always musical and, you know, did play the organ in church, but she had other sort of teaching jobs and things too. But
did you ever call auctions?
No.
No, you never got to.
It never interested me, or it's nothing I wanted to do, you know. Right. But I think the thing about growing up on a farm in Saskatchewan, that although, like, I'm obviously not a farmer, the thing that you see growing up that seeps its way into your bones if you grow up on a farm, and it certainly has applied to me, is the notion of work ethic and particularly, like, on a small scale grain farm, when it's harvest time, you bust your butt.
Right.
Like, because it will snow. And so, and sitting around hoping it will get done won't get it done. So, like, you do it. And, like, the clock doesn't matter. Like, and there's these things you see growing up in that environment where you're like, that's what work is. And that's really seeped into me, like, being an independent artist, like an independent small-scale farmer, you're like, this isn't going to get done if I don't do it.
Right.
You know, so I'm grateful for that.
Hey, it's Kevin. I hope you're enjoying the episode so far. Just a quick reminder that the SaaScapes podcast is available for free on your favorite podcast app, or you can stream it from your browser. Check out the show notes for the link. On the SaaScapes homepage, you'll notice something new under the logo called SaaScapes Plus. You can't miss it. There's a big button saying support with a heart icon next to it. I'd love it if you could click on that button and help keep this podcast series going. When SaaScapes launched in May 2014, it was the first podcast in the province celebrating arts, culture, and heritage. In fact, you'd have been pretty hard-pressed to find any Saskatchewan podcasts. So I'd like to think that we paved the way. It's been because of your support that this podcast is now in its 9th year. Okay, that's it. Enjoy the rest of the episode.
Were you the odd person out in your town because of the fact that you were studying piano?
A little. Like, I kind of was a kid who did a bit of everything. So I liked school sports and those sorts of things. The thing I really did not like, which was made me probably more the odd guy out in my town, was I did not like hockey. Like, I just wasn't good at it. I didn't like it. I didn't get the point of it. Like, I remember, it's so funny. I was discussing this with a friend the other day, another guy from another small town. And we were both like, I just didn't want the puck to come to me.
That's a pretty good sign.
It's a pretty good sign that I shouldn't be out there. Right. I was like, the last thing I wanted was the puck. Right. So the best thing that happened when I was 14, there weren't enough boys in my town to make up a bantam hockey team. So I got to quit. And those who were committed went to the next town. I got to play the piano more. Like, it let me study music more. So there was this weird built-in excuse for me to stop, which was the best thing ever.
Right.
And I got to curl more things.
I was going
to
ask. Yeah, you did?
I preferred curling. Curling was way more my speed.
Okay.
Me and the old ladies. It was great.
Right. So jumping forward to, you seriously did a Bachelor of Science degree in plant biology?
Yes.
Seriously?
Yeah, I did.
Before you went off to study music, or had you already?
That was after.
It was after?
Yeah, it was after.
So wait a second. Okay, so then how did the timeline go? When did you go to Ireland?
That was during my university degree where I was studying science. And so I had a scholarship to go away. So finished my piano studies in Regina.
Yeah.
And then went off to the U of S to study science, thinking I was going to be a dentist. This was the master plan. I will be a dentist, I told myself. Then I got into studying sciences. And some of my friends were, you know, that I met at university were in dental school. And I was like, I wasn't convinced that any of them really liked what they wanted to do. They all just wanted to make money. And maybe some of them did, but that wasn't the vibe I was picking up. And I kind of steered my ship away from that. And I was like, well, I'll just be a scientist, like some, you know, I don't know, garden variety scientist.
No pun intended.
Exactly. Right.
Right.
And so, but I got my degree, but in the process, I got a scholarship to go study anywhere in the UK or Ireland for a year. And it was a great scholarship. So off I went, and I got to pick my university, and I picked Queen's in Belfast. Right. And I was really interested in Ireland and the politics.
Yeah.
So when I went over there, I actually mostly studied, I studied a bunch of electives, because the credits could transfer back to Canada. It was a neat program, but I wanted to keep my major credits from here. Anyway, so what that did is it allowed me to study a lot of things like Irish literature and Irish history and Irish politics for a year in Ireland, and it was great. Like, I remember in one of my Irish lit courses at the Institute of Irish Studies in Belfast, like, Seamus Heaney gave us a lecture in poetry, and, you know, he's no lightweight.
Yeah, right.
So yeah, so there were great experiences. And I mean, I also discovered this incredibly musical place where, like, these top-notch musicians were playing in the corner of a pub. You couldn't throw a stick in a pub without hitting a really good musician. And I was just like, blown away by the whole thing. Mm. So it was, you know, it probably, you know, seeped its way into me a little bit too.
But why wasn't music foremost in your mind at that point as far as a career?
Well, I think I'd burnt out on it a bit due to my own doing when I was done at the conservatory, because I was practicing about 4 or 5 hours a day, and the works were quite big. Like, there were concertos and sonatas and, like, big, right, big works. And I got my licentiate diploma from Trinity College by the time I was done. And that's a big exam. I was 19. And after all that practicing, I had this realization, rightly so, that I was like, I don't want to be, nor do I really think I have the chops to be a professional concert pianist. I was kind of like, what the heck am I doing? So I was like, well, I'm going to go be a dentist. But what I never fathomed or even realized was a possibility was the singer-songwriter thing. Because like I didn't engage in, and there wasn't much of a singer-songwriter scene in Regina at the time. It was nothing that it didn't even enter my paradigm, right? Yeah. So then it was after I got my degree and realized I didn't want to be a scientist, because I'd kicked piano to the curb, essentially. I got this job in Toronto doing marketing, which is a whole weird story unto itself. So I moved off to Toronto, started doing this job, but quickly discovered a pretty vibrant singer-songwriter scene, right? As you know.
Yeah.
And I was like, holy smoke, this is like, someone just taught me how to like cook drugs in my bathtub. it was crazy. So it was pretty eye-opening and like fantastical. And I was going to all these gigs and checking this out. And what I realized, and this isn't like any kind of like arrogant statement, but I was like, these are all fairly mediocre musicians who are incredible wordsmiths. Like everybody is kind of playing four chords, but it's the words, you know? And that was not anything I'd ever done before. So I was like, well, I want to try this because I'm starting from a good place. I've got a lot of technical piano chops and ear training and whatever. So I started writing songs in Toronto, and the first ones were horrible. And, you know, but they have to be, right? Mm-hmm. But I was going to open mic nights and then doing those sorts of things. And I remember my first gig in the Art Bar at the Gladstone Hotel.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's an iconic place.
Yeah. But, I mean, it was all my friends who came. No one else came.
Yeah.
You know, you sing your songs and it's nerve-wracking. But it just like very gradually, the more I did it, the more people you notice are listening. And I'm my own worst critic. And had I noticed no one listening, I would be a dentist. but for better or for worse, people started listening. So I was like, well, you know, and I really enjoyed it. And I still do. Like, you could never do this, as you know, if you didn't love it. Like, you'd be a fool. If anybody got into music or wanted to be a singer-songwriter with the motivation to make money, I'd say, honey, go be an investment banker. Like, there's better ways to make money. You do it for the love of it, right?
Yeah.
So it was the more I got into it, I was like, oh, I really love this. And so, you know, but I was working in a job, right? So I was dabbling around in music, doing these open mic, nighttime gig sort of thing, but having a day job. And then, to condense it, I visited, after a couple years of doing that, I visited a great aunt in an old folks home in Toronto, and she had Alzheimer's. And I visited this great aunt with my grandma, who was her sister. And the great aunt Mary in the home, like, clearly no longer knew her sister. And there was something about the day, like, it was like I was thrown a sign. Like, something about the day, like, it really hit home. And I quit my job after that. Like, I was like, because I was like, that's going to be me. Or something like it, like, because you have no say in that. And everyone knows it. And we all dawdle around pretending like we don't know this, but we do.
Yeah.
But I was really like, why would I spend any waking hour not doing what it is that I know I want to do?
Right.
Knowing that that might be the possible sort of how the end of my road is painted. Like, we don't know. I don't know. You don't know. Yeah. And so it was enough motivation for me to make the leap. From a paycheck to and benefits to, you know, an awful lot of canned tuna and quite a few sofas.
Right. How did your family feel?
They thought I was crazy.
Right.
Completely crazy. Especially when I moved back in with my parents for 6 months when I came back to the prairies. And the only advice I would ever give to anybody thinking of doing this would be like, Figure out a way to do it without moving back in with your parents. Right. There's a reason why you move out, and you should never move back in.
Except it's all the rage now.
Oh, yeah. Well, now you just never leave.
Right. Well, why did you come back since you had been exposed to such major scenes?
Well, and everyone figures out their own way. Like, there's no handbook, there's no one can tell you. And if anyone tries to tell you, hey, here, kid, here's how you do the music business. Right. Run the other way, because those are the people you don't want to listen to. But I came back to the prairies because the first set of songs I recorded into an album were called Songs from Highway 15, and they were it was a prairie themed album. And I thought, well, if I try to perform this anywhere and try to, if I'm going to try to build an audience anywhere, this might mesh with the mindset of prairie people, these songs. So I was like, I'm going to plop myself back on the prairies and sing these songs. So in order to make that happen, for the first 6 months I moved back in with my parents on the farm, and I'm sure they were like, what? Huh. Like, where have we gone wrong? Right. Like, you know, right. Soon I was out of there. But yeah, that's why I came back. And then, you know, but I always kept a toe in the water in Toronto, and I still do. Like, yeah. I still keep a place there.
Right.
And it's been great because I bop back and forth between the two. Toronto can be my base for touring Ontario in the east. I'm in Regina an awful lot, touring like Saskatchewan, the prairies, out to the coast. Right. And that's been my model. Everyone does it differently, mm-hmm. you know? So, yeah, right. I wouldn't say it's the only way. It's not. Like, there's 100 ways to do it. So
right. And then in 2000, now I'm jumping ahead, 2014.
Yeah.
Significant year for you.
Yeah.
Chile.
That was weird. That was so weird. So, like, in 2013, I get this very random email that I thought was spam from this person in Chile Vision, the Chile Vision television station, just saying, hey, we found you on the internet, and there's this festival called Viña del Mar, and, you know, you should apply. We think you might have a fit with this thing. And I was like, yeah, whatever. And my uncle in Nigeria just wants to give me $10 kajillion.
Yeah,
like,
right.
Delete,
right,
you know? Right, So I was like, whatever. 3 months later, she messages again, just making sure you got my message. You know, I'm from Chile Vision. We produce this festival called Viña del Mar. You should really enter. So I Googled it, and I was like, oh, this thing's real, and it's quite large. I didn't really know what it was. I was like, to heck with it. I'll apply. There's no cost. So I applied, sent him one song and a back translated lyric sheet into Spanish, and that was it. And then a few months later, I get this email, and then I had phone calls waking me up at about 5 a.m. from this very bizarre area code repeatedly. And I was like, oh, who could be, like, what is this? So I answer, and it was them saying, the jury's met, and there's been over 1,000 entries, and we've picked 6, and you're one of them. And so would you be willing to give us 2 weeks of your time? We'll pay for your airfare and your food and your hotel, and you just got to come and rehearse for a week and sing for a week in Chile. And I was like, let me check my schedule.
Yeah, right.
Yes.
That's what you do.
Right? Exactly. But yeah, so I went down there and competed. And the Viña del Mar Festival is it's the biggest music festival in the Spanish-speaking world. One of the largest in the Western Hemisphere. Like, it's huge in terms of the people it draws to the festival and to the people who view it on TV. Like, the TV audience is what makes it the biggest. Uh-huh. And so they have major acts who perform at it, like the year before, the big headliner was Elton John. The year I was there, it was Rod Stewart, Ricky Martin. But then mostly Spanish speaking artists, like with a lean to Latin America. But they're huge, like they're millions of fans. And within that is the competition. And so I was one of six. I represented Canada, one of six countries. We rehearsed for a week, competed for a week. And through the competition, like, we're scored. It's live on TV, and there's 100 million people watch this thing on TV. And there's 20,000 people in the audience in this huge outdoor amphitheater in Viña del Mar in Chile. And through the course of the competitions, I was getting the high scores. And I was like, jeepers, like, I might have a chance at this thing. And then I ended up winning it. And so the television exposure was huge, yeah. Like, crazy. In that, like, leaving the country, like, through the airport in Santiago, like, it was like I had to have a security escort. Like, it was pretty funny. Like, I actually took it quite funny because I was like, this is ridiculous. Like, because I know when I land in Regina, no one's going to care. So it was funny. It was great. But the best part was that, you know, there's an audience now in Latin America. So
right,
that's cool.
Yeah. And how do you feel about this? I talked to Taryn Cochran about this too. How do you feel about the whole U.S. scene and the whole Canadian issue of you really have to leave Canada and go plant yourself in the States to become a huge hit?
Well,
or is that a hard market to crack into when you're Canadian, do you think?
Well, I might be an anomaly in that sense, but like my interest and therefore my effort has really been focused on touring back and forth across Canada, like rinse and repeat and rinse and repeat, you know, that sort of thing. And yeah, like I've played shows in the States and like some have been good, some have been bad, some have been amazing, but it's like, there's only so many hours in a day. There's only so many marketing dollars. There are only so many grants you can apply for to help you do what it is that you do.
Yeah.
I think it's just as important to decide what you're not going to do as it is to decide what it is that you're going to do.
Uh-huh.
And I've chosen to focus on Canada. And I've developed a pretty good audience in Canada. But I haven't developed really much of anything in the States. And I'm totally fine with that.
Right.
So, like, so I guess, so to your question is, do you need to make a rumble in the States to be big? Like, to be global big? Probably.
Right.
To be Canada big? Not at all. I don't think, and I have no delusions about, you know, like I don't pretend like I'm like huge in Canada either, but I'm big enough that it's my living, you know, like I have enough of an audience.
You
that
kind
like,
of are.
No. I mean, you know, I make a living from it, you know, and that's all I ever really wanted to do. So,
right.
You know, but for example, I played a festival in Indianapolis last summer, the Indianapolis Pride Festival, and it was a wonderful opportunity. Like there were 100,000 people at this festival, probably about 10 to 15,000 at the stage when we played our set. The Indianapolis Festival, like, found me from Googling and seeing what I was doing in Canada, ironically.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a little proof for me that was like, oh, you can keep doing your thing. The internet makes this world a very small place.
It sure does.
Yeah.
How do you feel about people who really just sit in their living room and post a video and then all of a sudden it goes viral and they haven't had to do the grunt work and the tuna and the sofa scene like you did, you know, like it just skyrocket right
away.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I would never begrudge anyone that. I mean, if that happens, awesome. Right. I don't know, like there's probably people even closer to me who've had that happen. But I mean, I guess one example is say that young guy who's Canadian and quite famous now, Shawn Mendes. I mean, he became famous from Vine posts.
Right.
And I know, like, I don't really follow that scene, but from what I gather from award shows and things, like, he's doing rather well, selling a lot of records. So, you know, it can be a way to launch your career. But it's like, and everyone has heard these stories, but for every story you've heard, there's 999,999 other people who've tried that and seen it fail.
Right.
But we all love to talk about the ones that it worked. And it's funny, I was actually just talking about this exact thing with Louis O'Reilly, who's a manager from Saskatoon, who's with this big management company in Canada called Invictus Entertainment. We were talking about, like, how do you break an artist to the public? And he said, you know, you're going to hear about artists who have a viral video, it breaks their career, Bob's your uncle, everyone's heard of them, and off they go.
Right.
He said, however, that's not controllable. So he said, if for someone like him who has a big management company, and if they're trying to break an artist, they're not going to sit around making YouTube videos hoping. They're going to make a really good record with really good songs and tour the crap out of it.
Right.
Because that's a controllable.
Right.
You know, so yeah, people do break their career through a YouTube video, and that's awesome. But there's a lot of luck involved in that.
Yeah, and don't you think it affects the work? I mean, don't you sort of bypass the work ethic that you need to?
I think, like, my feeling is about, from what I've seen happen in music, and there's exceptions to this for sure, but the faster you rise, the faster you fall.
Yeah.
Period.
Yeah.
You know? And so I think if you've, like, and a lot of the people who I would say my musical peers in my, you know, whatever, from around Regina or Saskatchewan or whatever, you know, if you've had your hand in the pot of booking shows, doing some marketing, figuring out tour routing, hiring a band, figuring out which publicist will work for you, like, and that list goes on. If you've done all that, then you've got this set of skills that, like, it makes it harder for you to fall, because you can control a lot of these things that, or you can use some of these tools to keep you afloat. That if you go from nothing to famous and have no idea how you got there, like, then unless a big label picks you up, or a label picks you up and then says, you know, we're gonna run with this, like, in a year, if they don't like you and they drop you, well, then what do you do?
Yeah, I think longevity is a far more attractive attribute than an overnight sensation.
To me, it is.
I think so.
Yeah, yeah.
No, I mean, why would you want a career that fizzles out as fast as it launches?
Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, at the same time, I mean, like, let's say I got to where I am now, and let's say all of a sudden tomorrow, Ellen phoned and said, "Would you come to my show?" I would say yes.
Yeah, but I wouldn't see that as all of a sudden an overnight sensation. I mean, you're putting in the grunt work now, so that would just be a byproduct of that.
I guess.
I would think so.
But it's an interesting conversation. Yeah. Like, I love that conversation because it's quite healthy, I think, for all independent artists to think of that. Like, how much work are you willing to do, you know, right, to get you to wherever it is that you're trying to get to?
Well, I think overnight sort of sets you up with a mindset of, wow, I'm all that and more, that I could get it like that.
Yeah.
And then you sort of come, it raises the bar of your own self-perception of your worth and your value. And all of a sudden, when somebody doesn't worship you on that level, you start sinking.
I think your perception of what reality is, it gets totally screwed up.
Yeah. How do you feel about being compared to people? Like, there's a part of me that always wishes people wouldn't say, "Wow, you know who you sound like." It's almost sometimes offensive, except you're compared to people that are pretty heavy hitters. So
it's funny. Like, a lot of people hate comparisons. On the other hand, I think human beings are human beings, and people have, like, just like our laptop is divided into folders so we can keep things organized, in our brains there are invisible folders. Mm-hmm. And your iTunes folders are kind of up there and like where you go. So when people hear someone new, it's very human to compare it to what you already know, to understand where it fits. Like, how else? You need a point of reference. So I often get Elton John. I often get Billy Joel. Those are probably the most two common ones. And I get some Rufus Wainwright. I get some Harry Chapin, I get some Ben Folds, and like blah. It's a list like that.
Are those people you listen to? Do you think you're influenced by them?
Yeah, like I do. And I mean, you know, it's very possible that I probably sound like some of that. Like, I would never deny it because I listened to a fair bit of that, and I think they're all very good at what they do. And I listened to a lot of it, and so I think your output is probably the result of a sum of inputs, you know, getting blended up in your little brain blender and then coming out of your music,
right?
So it's probably inevitable. Do I hate it? Well, I don't hate it. But I mean, the thing that I find kind of funny is, like, people will come up to me and say these things, like, with the presumption that I've never heard it. They're like, "Do you know who you sound like?" Right. And I'm like, "Who?" And they're like, "A young Elton John." And I'm like, "Oh, God, I've never heard that." Except 999 other times.
right. So it's okay as long as the person you like.
Yeah, exactly. Like, "Did you know you sound like Barry Manilow?" I was like, "Oh, great."
He's a Barry fan. Early Barry.
Exactly. Yeah, I don't know. But
right.
Yeah. People compare all the time, but I bet every band gets that.
Probably.
Yeah.
I just don't know whether every band finds that I was just curious to know whether you found that to be complimentary or
insulting. I don't take that as an insult or a compliment. I just sort of take it. When I hear people say that, what I hear is them putting me in a filing cabinet. Like that. That's all I hear.
Yeah, but you're not you're not a mimic artist.
No. And one of the great thing is that people generally, by and large, qualify it with that. They're like, "I'm not saying I think you're trying to sound like that." They're saying, they're saying, like, in fact, one lady came up to me at the end of a show 3 days ago and she said, "I can't wait till Elton John dies." And I was like, "Why?" She said, "Because you're going to be the next one." She said, "He's past his prime." I was like, "Okay, I'll take that, I guess. I don't know." I was like, "I quite like him, actually."
Yeah, I wouldn't put him past his prime.
No. I mean, this is what she said. I'm repeating what she said.
Right.
But she meant it in the best way. So people are making these comparisons, and it's a nice way, I think. They're trying to be nice, I think. Yeah.
I hope you're enjoying this episode. Just a reminder that there are several ways that you can listen to all of the SaaScapes episodes. The easiest way is with the SaaScapes app that you can download for free from the App Store or Google Play, depending on your device. You'll even get notifications when a new episode is available. Other ways to hear the podcasts are downloading them from the iTunes Store, Stitcher Radio, or through the TuneIn Radio app. Again, all for free. You can stream the SaaScapes podcasts individually
at www.iheartculture.ca. Thanks to all of you who have been writing your comments and reviews. It's always great to hear from you. And now, back to the podcast.
We're sitting beside your piano right now. Do you ever get up some days and look at it and hear it and just say, get away from me? Like, are there times when you just need to turn the music off?
I don't think there's times when I need to, but there's times, like, not to get away from music, but there's times when I have to just because I have to do the administrative stuff. And I think that balance is not, like, and it's a very skewed balance because you end up doing more time on the admin work than you do on making the music. That's just the nature of being an independent musician. So the time you're forced to be away from making the music to keep up with the admin work, I think keeps that from happening. Like, keeps you from feeling stale or, you know, just having it, like, right, having too much of the music, you know. Right. And in a way, I think if anything, I'm constantly craving more time with it because I don't think there's enough.
Okay.
To keep the boat floating, you spend a lot of time doing admin work and applying for grants and doing your marketing and doing your social media and dealing with my agent or my publicist or whatever. And then by the time all that's done, you're like, God, I got to write a new song. You know, I've got this idea. Carving out the time for the music is actually the harder part, and I crave more of it.
Right. But there are times when you just need – do you love silence? I mean, are you one of those people that constantly has to have something playing in the background?
No, I'm a runner, so I use my running time as my silent time. Mm-hmm. I mean, sometimes I have headphones on, but my dirty secret is, as I'm running, they're often not on. But it keeps people from stopping and talking to you.
It's a good old Toronto trick.
Exactly. Subway, yeah, sidewalk. Yeah, it's a Toronto trick. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Don't dare talk to me. I have these headphones in my ear.
I have been known to pull my phone out when I see somebody that I don't want to talk to. I know.
I thought that was just me.
It can be very convenient.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So, yeah, so my running time is my thinking.
Okay.
Time.
Yeah. All right. Is there a genre of music you don't care for?
Probably. I mean, like, it's only because I don't understand it and haven't had a lot of time with it, but, like, say, like, screamo or, like, heavy, like, German metal. I just don't quite get it. I don't quite get it. You know, it's not that I find it repulsive. I mean, I just listen to it. I'm like, I just don't get this, you know?
Right.
But yeah, I mean, I try to keep an open mind to everything because there could be ideas in it. But I mean, it wouldn't be what I gravitate to.
Okay.
That stuff, yeah.
You gravitate toward Beethoven sometimes, and there's a 6 degrees of Beethoven story that you have.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Very good. It's funny. I didn't actually know it existed at the time. But it's interesting. I think it's interesting in hindsight because when I was studying at the conservatory, this is how this happened. My teacher at the conservatory in Regina was Frank Crumley, and Frank was a student for a while of Thomas Mansart. Thomas Mansart was a well-known Regina Saskatchewan piano prof at the U of R for a long time. He was a really good piano player. And Thomas studied with a guy named Leschetizky, who studied with Howard Wells, or the other way around, who studied with Czerny, who studied with Beethoven. So if you go through the teacher-student lineage, 6 degrees, I go from me to Beethoven. Like, and it's kind of crazy.
And Chopin, too.
Well, yeah, and Chopin, too. If you branch off the other way, it goes to Chopin. But the reason I find the Beethoven part more interesting, personally, is because when I was in music festivals and doing my exams with the conservatory or Trinity or whatever, my Beethoven march went through the roof constantly. Like, not in the other classes. The other classes I did fine, but I didn't do that well. But my Beethoven classes, like, I once had an adjudicator say, that was like I was listening to Beethoven. Like, and how he knew, I don't know. You know, he's never heard Beethoven. But I'll never forget him saying it. And I was like, that's a weird thing to say. And so then, fast forward years later, when I run into Thomas's, because Thomas had just passed away, and his partner, who I'm told, Lawrence, we just struck up a conversation somewhere because we were talking about Thomas, and he told me this lineage, and I was like, "Are you kidding me?" I said, "That's so weird." And he said, "Yeah." He said a lot of, you know, students who have sort of passed through Thomas have noticed this Beethoven or Chopin thing. And I was like, that's crazy. Because myth, I mean, and that actually makes more sense with teaching methods and, you know, learning than it would with genealogy, right?
Right.
So in that regard. So I find it quite fascinating.
You should have, when the adjudicator said that, you should have said, what? Sorry.
I can't hear you.
Must be something in there.
Must be something in my inner ear.
Yeah.
Oh. Oh. That's good.
Charity work is a big deal for you as well.
Yeah.
You're really involved in Telemiracle.
Yeah.
You're on television every 5 seconds right now for the commercial.
So there.
Yeah. How did you stumble into that?
Telemiracle. They called me up about 4 years ago and asked if I would be part of the national cast. So Telemiracle has, like, people in Saskatchewan would know this. I'm sure your podcast has reached beyond Saskatchewan, but Saskatchewan people would know this because it's a Saskatchewan thing. A 20-hour telethon run by the Kinsmen and Canets, and it makes millions of dollars to help people from Saskatchewan with health needs that are unmet by Medicare. That's sort of like the Reader's Digest version. Mm-hmm. So anyway, they called me up because they have a national cast that keeps the show going, hosting and performing, while in the meantime, throughout all that is woven a whole bunch of Saskatchewan talent who do like one song. Whatever. So they called me up and said, would you consider being part of the national cast? And I said, yeah, that would be pretty cool. So I did it the first year. Total green newbie. Didn't really know what I was doing, but really enjoyed it. Mm. Kind of drank the Kool-Aid because I really got it. Like when I was there, I was like, oh my goodness. Like you see these families coming with kids who have things that I didn't know existed that like Medicare doesn't cover it. Medicare, that's when I really realized. I was like, Medicare doesn't cover an awful lot of things. Like, it was a real eye-opener. And without the Kinsmen Foundation, like, I don't know what these people would do. They don't know what they'd do. A lot of them were incurring huge personal debts to pay for medical needs. And it was crazy. But to see the good that did was amazing. And so I went back, and now they keep inviting me back as part of the national cast, which is great. And the only year I missed was when I went to Chile, because that overlapped with Telemiracle.
You pull an all-nighter hosting?
I have. Once I pulled an all-nighter, you get scheduled in a shift. You get sleep. You do get a sleep slot. But one night I got slotted to the overnight hosting with Andrea Menard, which I think was one of my favorite hosting gigs because you just kind of, you're running on coffee and chocolate. Like this. which, first of all, was amazing. Second of all, Andrea's a hoot, so that was good.
Right.
And we had great chemistry. Like there's things that can happen in that overnight shift on Telemiracle that like, because kind of everyone else has gone to bed and they're like, here's the mic, there's the camera, off you go. And so I remember what this cover band was out there, or in the overnight shift, there's a band doing a 6-song set or something. And my job is to wander on and off the stage in between songs, just kind of talk to them and sort of string it along and whatever. So they're doing some AC/DC cover and I wasn't really paying attention because I was backstage eating chocolate. Coffee down my shirt and chocolate on my cheek. And so I heard silence on the stage. And like I had, because when you hear like dead air is like the enemy of the show, it can't stop. Like the show just has to keep going. It's 20 hours of nonstop live TV, which is really difficult.
Right.
And you can't have dead air. I'm backstage eating chocolate, and I hear this dead air, and I'm like, oh! So I grabbed the mic and go running on the stage, and I was like, and I forget the band's name. I wish I could remember, but I said, oh, thanks, that was so great. But it was just a big, long pause in the song. And they all turned to me, and then kept playing the song, and I was like, oops. And I walked back up. And I was like, well, it's 3 a.m. Who saw this? Well, about 1,000 people.
Sure.
Because I've had it played back to me, like,
right,
constantly. So that was kind of funny.
Okay. And you got to work with Bob McGrath.
Yeah.
Sesame Street.
Sesame Street, hero from my childhood, and like total talent.
Mm-hmm.
A great guy, like gifted performer, good soul. And last year was his last year doing that show. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he sort of took a bow and that was that because it was time. He felt it was time to be done. And, but what a great guy.
There'd be a way that I ask you this or not, so you don't really have to answer. You don't want to, but I know you're out.
Yeah.
Comfortable with that.
Yeah.
How has it been being received in the music scene as, I'm not going to say, well, you're not labeled as Jeffrey Straker, the gay artist.
No.
I mean, if people know that part of your story, has that affected you adversely in any way?
You know, it's funny. At first I thought it might, and then I realized that it didn't and doesn't in the circles that I perambulate in. Like, I think if I were to show up at a, this might be stereotypical, but if I showed up at a country music festival, I don't think that could fly as well. But for what I do and where I am, I really realized that by and large, and by and large, people, I think, like to gravitate to an artist, I think, that A, they like the music, but B, they find some honesty in it. And I think what I've observed is that if you reveal your true self and let your true self be seen, I think people, like whatever that true self is, I think people see something in that. Mm-hmm. Because I think probably subconsciously when I first was starting, I probably attempted to like hide, if that's even possible, being gay, because I'm pretty out there. But you know, but then it was a gradual thing, but I realized I don't have to do that. And I mean, I have some songs that are like quite gay themed and whatever. And I found just like the most unlikely people liking them. Like, you know, some seemingly stereotypical straight white dude being like, I love that song about the gay kid from your hometown. Like, you know, and then they'd say why. And I was like, that's fascinating. Right. I have had a few people not like it, like email me and saying like, stop pushing your agenda, whatever. But the haters will hate, whatever, who cares? But I think by and large, it's been okay. And one of the things that I think is funny is that I think most people, like if you took a survey of people across Canada and said, where's the least likely place in the country where a gay singer-songwriter would find an audience, they'd probably say, Saskatchewan, you know? And it's not the case. Right. It's not the case at all. I'd be the first to say that. Like, it's been a wonderful place, I think, for me to find ears for my music. exactly. That too. Yeah.
Probably there anywhere.
So, yeah. And I mean, I'm doing a show November 20th at the Casino Show Lounge. I mean, it's selling really well. Like, you know, it looks like it's on track to sell out the room, and it's really nice to see, you know, like I don't feel like there's any kind of discrimination per se, you know, I like that you asked the question because I think it's a good conversation to be had. I think this province, has really grown up in that regard. It's not fixed. Nothing ever, like no place is perfect, but you know, the majority, pretty cool.
Phil, I'm glad you made the phone call to the radio station over the ice cream cone incident last summer.
Yeah, that was weird.
Yeah.
But that was a bad apple, right?
It was, but it was good that you
said something. Yeah, I mean, really all I did was post on Facebook. I was like, hey, this just happened, you know, in downtown Regina, right, when I was called a fag on the street buying ice cream. And I was like, here's what I did. What would you do? And I mean, it was amazing to see the response from all across Canada, like the way it got shared and stuff, mm-hmm. and then picked up by some radio and TV. Mostly, I think, in terms of like, I think everyone kind of tried to make it a bit of a teaching moment. I think, you know, which was great. That's kind of what I thought, you know. It's like, I didn't want to sit around dwelling on it being like, oh, Regina's homophobic, because I don't think that's the case. That's not what I think at all. But I mean, you know, there's bad apples everywhere. And it was a neat sort of little time to maybe open a few more eyes that maybe hadn't been opened or something.
What's your favorite word?
Beautiful.
What's your least favorite word?
Gotcha.
What's your favorite sound?
An oboe.
Yeah, me too. I love the oboe.
It's gorgeous, right?
Gabriel's Lament, the beginning of the Mission.
I know.
The movie.
Yeah.
So beautiful.
Yeah.
Enrico Morricone. What's your least favorite sound?
Nails on a chalkboard.
Right. What is your favorite swear word?
Oh, it's the C word.
Oh, it's the C word.
I went to university in Ireland and everyone says it there.
I know. And in Australia.
Too. Yes, I know. Yeah, it's terrible, but it just comes out of me all the time and I get the strangest looks. It's not good. It's not good.
I know. I'll never forget the first day I said it. I'm jumping through some of them. I'm
That's
not,
okay.
Because we don't have time to do
That's
all okay. of them. If heaven exists mm-hmm. and you encounter St. Peter or God, both mm-hmm. of them together mm-hmm. at this pearly gates, mm-hmm. What would you like him or her mm-hmm. to say about how you lived your life?
Oh, probably that I think I'm glad you gave it everything you had and glad you tried to leave the world in a bit of a better place than it was before you joined it.
Mm-hmm.
That's my hope.
Mm-hmm.
I hope that's what they say about everybody.
Mm-hmm.
But they won't.
And if this music thing doesn't pan out for you, there's always dentistry.
Yep.
I'm just still trying to get the connection between plant biology and dentistry.
I started out just doing biosciences.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
I'm looking to see if there's a garden out there, but it's the wrong time.
There's plenty of perennials because I'm never here enough long. I'm never here long enough to make annuals live.
I was going to ask you, are you ever home?
In bits and bobs.
You leave tomorrow, right?
Yeah. But only for 8 days. Just enough in time to come back and water things.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for sprinkling a little water on the podcast and finally making it happen.
This was great. I have a feeling we could talk for another 3 hours
here. I know. Now I'm thinking, damn, why do you have a 3 o'clock?
I know.
And I have a 4 o'clock.
I know.
Well, that just means we'll have to do part two.
Exactly. Well, congrats on the success you've had with it, though. I hope it can keep going.
Congrats on the success that you're having. The title of the new album?
Like the next one?
No, the one that just came out.
North Star Falling.
Yes.
Yeah.
And, it's the last one.
Oh!
Great song.
Thanks a lot.
Great song. You write good tunes.
Thanks. It's a very optimistic song, right?
Treat
today like it's the last one.
Well, my mom is 89, and most of the stuff she hears on the radio, she runs for the off button. And when she first heard the podcast, she said, I really like that song. Who is that?
The Slings and Arrows song.
Yes.
Oh.
So if an 89-year-old mother likes the Slings and Arrows song, then you've got my mother stamp for approval, which is a huge deal.
Which is a huge deal.
Big deal.
She's a big credit. Well, good.
Yeah.
Tell her I thank her for that.
Great. Well, travel safely.
Thank you. And see you again for part two.
Hey, thanks for listening. The SaaScapes podcast is created and hosted by Kevin Power for SaaS Culture. Funding to the cultural sector is provided through the Saskatchewan Lottery's Trust Fund for Sport, Culture, and Recreation. For more information, visit iheartculture.ca and saasculture.ca. You can follow us on Twitter at SaaScapes and at Kevin Power Live. Music for SaaScapes is provided by Saskatchewan-born singer-songwriter Jeffrey Straker. These are our stories, Saskatchewan, and they have no end. So tell me, what's yours?